My name is Mary Johnston. I'd like to welcome you to DBSA Boston. Glad to see such a crowd here. That's exciting. Must be the spring weather. I'll introduce our speaker. She is our own Cynthia Pilch, who is most importantly a DBSA facilitator. But she's also a Reiki master and peer specialist. She's an educator, consultant, and clinical practitioner, and is trained in a variety of integrative healing modalities. She maintains a private clinical practice in Lexington, Massachusetts, and I will turn the time over to her. Please welcome Cynthia.
Thank you, Mary. So you've just heard a little bit about my bio, and now it's time to share the full story of my vulnerabilities and strengths. Can you hear me now? Okay. All right. So here are some key facts of my background. I'm a white 66-year-old woman. I'm the oldest daughter and second oldest child in a working-class Jewish family of nine children. I grew up first in Cambridge, where I was a minority as a Jew in my school. And then we moved to Brookline when I was 11, and I became a minority as a working class person from a large family in my school. From a very early age, I felt both different and less than others around me. I have a history of so many mental health challenges from both sides of my family that it would truly be safe to say you could drown in my gene pool. What I've learned in following the lessons from my family are the following. You are what you do. You can do anything if you work hard enough. So if you're not doing what you want to do, it's because you're not working hard enough. What other people think of you is paramount. So never, never, never shame the family. What happens in the family stays in the family. Never think you are better than other people, no matter how much more you may have or do. And while for some people they live by the adage, to those whom much is given, much is expected, in my family, you live by the rule that to those whom anything was given, much was expected. My major personal vulnerabilities and challenges have included the following. I'm a very highly sensitive person who feels overly responsible for others' well-being. I'm a perfectionist and have chronic self-confidence struggles that started in childhood and persist today. I should, in fact, have started a Perfectionist Anonymous Club long ago, but haven't done it because I never felt confident that I could do it perfectly. I had great trouble from second grade on reading and concluded that I was stupid compared to my older brother and younger sister and other classmates. My slow reading led to high grades but terrible standardized scores from the time I was in grade school, and culminated in high school, my senior year, when I received a rejection from the University of Massachusetts and an acceptance to Harvard Radcliffe on the same day. That is true. And I've always wanted to write it into Ripley's Believe It or Not. I, of course, assumed that U of Mass was right and Harvard terribly wrong by accepting me. Rather than feeling relief the following year, my freshman year at Harvard, when I was flunking a Spanish class and was diagnosed with dyslexia, I instead felt like that diagnosis confirmed that I had a defective brain and accomplished everything by being an overachieving scrapper. Therefore, I told no one outside my family about the dyslexia for many years. I've also had numerous health challenges, including 5 head injuries over 10 years, resulting in several concussions and whiplash experiences. And as you can see, I never played football. 6 hospitalizations, 3 for depression, 1 for middle ear, 1 for thyroid surgery, and 2 for cancer surgeries. 4 in or outpatient surgeries, 1 to repair my knee, 1 to remove my thyroid, 1 to remove cancer on my face, and 1 to remove cancer in my right breast. Other diagnoses I have experienced are PTSD, bipolar 2, Grave disease, Lyme disease, toxic hepatitis, and vertigo. My perspective on all of these has changed over time, but my most positive changes in thinking about them and my self-determination has revolved around my mental health challenges. Those positive changes got me thinking about how self-determination has impacted my evolving mental health recovery. That's what led me to write a paper on the subject and to give this presentation. What is mental recovery and what is self-determination? One of those things, self-determination, is asking people to speak more quietly while I'm trying to speak. For me, mental recovery is having people who I love and love me, meaningful activities, and a capacity to demonstrate compassion for others and, most importantly, myself. Self-determination is the self-confidence and agency to drive, steer my own life's journey. Because my first depressive episode happened at age 40, I had a lot of time to develop and practice self-determination. And here are some examples. One was going for help with my reading, and in fact insisting to my parents that I had to go for that help in second grade to avoid being kept back a grade. Another was deciding at 16 to apply for and ultimately to go to Indonesia as a summer exchange student against advice of family and several family friends. That experience of living as a Jew in a Muslim family and being the only white person in my community taught me a lot about the value and importance of cross-cultural and cross-racial experiences. Moving to Appalachia for 2 years after college to work in a community action agency in response to my parents forbidding me to join the Peace Corps. That job ultimately led to my career in public health and passion for working with underserved populations. The most important acts of self-determination in terms of impacting my life was moving back to Boston to live with my then boyfriend and now husband of some 35 years, Mr. Jamie Katz, who is here, despite my parents' strong objections to my just living with him, because good girls don't do that. I had a responsibility to be a good example for my younger siblings. And most importantly to me, what would people think? Despite this strong history of using self-determination in my career and relationship, I have faced enormous challenges doing so during at least 2 of my 3 bouts of profound depression, the primary symptoms of which have included trouble thinking clearly, low energy, and profound self-contempt. The tools that have helped me to strengthen my self-determination are the following: access to accurate and balanced information about potential services and resources, emotional, physical, and financial support from others. Exposure to potential mentors, coaches who have the lived experience of mental health challenges, a willingness to experiment with various interventions and recovery strategies, and opportunities to have meaningful activities that can boost self-confidence. I will give you a couple of examples of each category. In terms of access to accurate and balanced information about potential services and resources, when I was 21 years old and working at Cambridge Hospital as a mental health worker, I had a lovely woman, older woman, who happens to be the same age I am now, come in with catatonia. And I was initially mortified when professionals decided to give her what was then called shock treatment, because I viewed it as barbaric and punitive from watching One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. But when I watched her brought back to life 3 weeks later of, quote, shock treatment, I vowed to tell anyone I knew with profound depression to consider that treatment and to not be such an arrogant young person in the future. Never, never did I anticipate that I would be the person who would advocate to receive what is now called ECT treatment. But 20 years after making that vow to myself, I was profoundly depressed and had tried 12 different medications without success. And I pleaded with doctors to try ECT and got the help of my lawyer husband in supporting me that was worth trying. And indeed, I had ECT, which finally brought back the, quote, light to my eyes. Although I thought that would be my only depressive episode, when I had a second one 10 years later, I decided that I needed more information about ECT. And I read Kitty Dukakis's and Larry Tye's seminal book, Shock, which is in the toolbox that I have somewhere. Is it down here? All right, that's my toolbox, okay? And it's in there, so anybody can look at it. And so I read that book, and that's a story. How many people know who Kitty Dukakis is? Well, this is a remarkable reflection that this is Massachusetts, because Kitty is an incredible woman in her own right, and she happens to also be the wife of Governor Michael Dukakis. And she and he have used their celebrity status to really try to bring more visibility to mental health issues. And about the time of my second depressive episode, she was starting a support group called ECT, A Light in the Darkness, and invited me to join. And since that time, I and my husband have been active members. And that group is really focused on trying to bring balanced information about ECT to both recipients of ECT and families. Not just information, but also support. So one of the things that grew out of membership in that group is that I helped to start a support group for ECT patients here at McLean. And that has been an enormous experience over the last 5 years and has benefited me in some ways that I will share a little later. So, second type of tool is support from helpful others. I'm a very lucky person. I've had caring friends and family always. And I want to say that some of that family is here tonight, including my husband and my daughter and my nieces and my brother-in-law. So I thank you for coming. Because for those of us who've had mental health issues, we know it's a family affair. It's not just one person's journey. My second depressive episode brought a realization that I was dealing with a chronic illness and that I really needed to know some other people who were dealing with that condition. So I joined this organization and became both an in and outpatient facilitator. My membership here introduced me to the BU Center for Psychiatric Rehabilitation, where I became a student and then a wellness instructor. At both DBSA and BU, I have met many other high-functioning people with mental health challenges who have been colleagues and friends. The culture here and at BU helps me face the internalized stigma that made me hide my mental health diagnoses just as I had hidden my dyslexic ones for so many years. Not only because of how I feared others would judge me, but most importantly, because how I judged myself. The process of coming, quote, out of the closet for me has been a decade-long one and has included starting mental health initiative at my synagogue, some of whom are here tonight, my buddies from there, running peer support groups here and elsewhere, speaking about my recovery story at NAMI and other public conferences, and becoming a certified peer specialist to remind myself of my commitment to walk the talk of mental health recovery, self-determination, and peer work. I treasure a framed photo voice project I keep on my bureau because it tells me my coming out story of being public about my mental health challenges. And I also have that in my toolbox, so you all are welcome to take a look afterwards. The third area is a willingness to keep trying various approaches. Over the last 25 years, I have used a broad array of tools for well-being. Everything from adequate sleep, daily exercise, Reiki, meditation, cognitive behavioral and talk therapies, yoga meditation, and ECT. Doing that required an open mind to try modalities despite my skepticism. And I have to say, the two that win the award for my greatest level of skepticism are, interestingly enough, ECT and Reiki. And those have become the two most valuable tools in my toolbox when I am the sickest. 30 years ago, I would never have considered being a poster child for either ECT or Reiki. But now I sing their praises because of their star roles in my mental health recovery, and I encourage others to consider them in their journeys. Having personally meaningful activities is the next category. As the middle-aged adult when I had my first depressive episode, I had experienced a number of meaningful roles and activities, which helped me know that I was more than my diagnoses or periodic symptoms. My roles as mother and teacher have been particularly powerful, challenging, and rewarding. One of my hardest moments in life was telling my then 12-year-old daughter, Lee, that I had to go to the hospital with depression, and hearing her fear and disbelief, because how could I be depressed when she saw me as always cheerful? I hoped back then that my going to the hospital would help model the importance of knowing when you need help and seeking it out. I also hoped it would teach her that you can't judge a book by its cover. People can look terrific and feel terrible inside. Talking to her inspired me to fight even harder because I knew She needed me and she loved me. My role as a teacher at BU has enabled me to give back to others with mental health challenges and to grow as a teacher and a person. And I must confess, I've had just a tad bit of pride in proving all the naysayers wrong that you shouldn't teach Reiki to people with mental health conditions because it might not be safe. Because I have had the pleasure of teaching many people Reiki at the BU Center and watching their self-confidence and their enormous talent come out. I have treasured the joy in watching them expand their skills and self-confidence. Most recently, my greatest example of how giving back and giving forward intersect and how my growth in self-determination has strengthened my mental health recovery is that with my most recent episode of depression this past fall, I actually recognized it while I was teaching a 6-part workshop for people dealing with cognitive challenges after ECT. And I didn't delay going to talk about my symptoms with the head of the ECT department, who I trusted enormously. While I suspected that I looked and sounded just fine, I was feeling great self-contempt inside. So I chose to miss the last class of that workshop in spite of my enormous sense of responsibility for others, and to come inpatient to receive a series of ECT treatments. And when I felt the depression lift while here during my 66th birthday, I thought, now there's a present, along, of course, with lifetime membership in the McLean Alumni Association. Thanks for listening, and I hope I've shared some helpful thoughts about the role of self-determination in mental health recovery. Because I have made some progress in my perfectionism, I know this presentation can't be perfect, but I hope it has been, quote, my new standard, good enough for each of you to add something of value to your own toolbox. Now it's time to share your questions and comments. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Cynthia. That was so inspiring. How did you get into Reiki? What was it that motivated you or brought you into that piece of tool in your toolbox?
Thanks, Joanne. Okay, so my first degree, not my first, but my PhD is in public health. And so I think of myself as a scientist, even if a social scientist. So I'm always looking at the data, right? And there was, 25 years ago, there was no data about Reiki. And what happened is, in my first episode of depression was triggered, all of my episodes of depression have been triggered by some physical health challenge. The first one, I have to tell you this in order for you to the first one was a car accident that created back problems so that I could not sit down for 8 months with such pain that I wrote the first 2 or 3 chapters of my dissertation, which was on, interestingly enough, gender and stress, lying down, okay? So when I couldn't move practically, one of my friends gave me a gift certificate to a massage therapist who figured out that the problem was that my sacroiliac joint, which is the joint that holds your pelvis in place, had been knocked out of place. The physical therapist hadn't figured that out. The orthopedic surgeon hadn't figured that out. But a massage therapist figured it out. So I remember saying to my husband, Jamie, if I get through this depression, I'm going to massage school. He said, you get through this, you can do any damn thing you want. So I enrolled in massage school. Only what happened was I went to massage school, and as my husband has also said, if there's an easy or a hard way, I'll find the hardest way. So I enrolled, and the first semester I got tendonitis in both my arms. And I went to the doctor, hand doctor, and he said, you've got to drop out of school. You have arthritis, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I said, I'm not dropping out of school. I'm not becoming downwardly mobile to drop out. And so I went back to a massage therapist who very wisely said to me, you know, I have worked on pieces of marble that are easier to maneuver than your shoulders. You need energy work. So I, after all being a PhD, thought I knew it all, said, oh, you mean acupuncture? I'd heard of that. No, she said, something gentler you can learn to do yourself. Reiki. And I looked at her and I said, what the hell is that? And her response to me was, universal healing energy. I don't know how many of you can see me, especially with my glasses, but I rolled my eyes. I said, deliver me. I'm a scientist. And she said the only thing she could have said to a smartass like me. She said, you're a scientist, go experiment. I went back to school, and I swear this is the truth, because after all, I can't bring shame to my family by lying. I went back to school, and in the student lounge, there was a poster. It had a rainbow. It said, bring light into your life. Learn Reiki. And there was a phone number. I called the phone number. They said, we're having a clinic tomorrow. Why don't you come? I came to the clinic, and on the way over, the left side of my brain said, what are you wasting your time, energy, and money on that woo-woo stuff? The right side of my brain said, what are you so afraid of? And I went to the clinic. I laid down on the table. And three clinicians worked on me. And my body literally started to shake like I was a fish out of water. But I wasn't afraid. I somehow knew it was right. And I said, I have to learn this. I learned it. I worked out my own tendonitis. I finished massage school. I've integrated into all of my care, and the rest is history. And had I gone with my uneducated, unexperienced, untested assumptions, God knows, I certainly wouldn't be doing the work I'm doing now. So it's a fine example of where our arrogance and our fear can get in the way. And so now, you know, this is the way I feel. I think every person should know Reiki. I think there'd be a lot less drug addiction, a lot less pain, etc. And one last thing on it. This will show you that my self-determination is pretty strong now. When I found out that I had breast cancer a year ago and went to meet with the surgeon, a woman, an important thing to say that she's a woman, because she came in and she looked straight at my chest, not, I don't think, in any inappropriate way, and said, how are you doing? And I looked at her chest and said, how would you be doing? Touché, she said. I said, oh, we're going to get along, fine. And so she said, and I said, you know, I have a question to ask you that would really help me with my surgery. And she said, what's that? I said, can I have a Reiki practitioner in the operating room? And she didn't just say no. She paused and she said, well, you know, it would have to be a BI employee. I said, I can do that because I volunteer here. So I know some nursing staff. And she said, okay then. And so I had a Reiki practitioner in the operating room. And not only that, even more importantly, when my family asked me, was there anything they could do to help me, the two most important people in my life, my husband Jamie and my daughter Lee, I said, there's one thing you can do. And they said, what's that? And I said, you can learn Reiki so that you can be there with me before and after the surgery. And they both did it. I'm not saying they ever used it since then, but they did it. And that meant a lot. And so I went into that surgery believing that, of course, I was going to be fine. And, you know, it really, really makes a difference. So anybody who wants to know, feel free.
Pardon my ignorance. You use the word Reiki a lot, but I have no idea what it is.
Thank you so much, Barry. He isn't a plant. He's just really... How many people know what Reiki is? Well, that's a lot more than would have 25 years ago. So we're making progress. Reiki is a very gentle energy balancing methodology and relaxation technique that comes from Japan, was brought here through Hawaii. And it's really predicated on the notion that we're all energy systems, much like acupuncture. Mm-hmm. Have you ever heard the term chakra, which is an energy center? Okay, so the way I think about it, because I'm a visual kind of person, is I think we're all like sophisticated plumbing systems, okay? And what happens when the plumbing gets clogged up, right? You have to Roto-Rooter it, right? So I sort of think of Reiki as the Roto-Rooterer. And I think what happens is, it's very gentle because there's no needles. The practitioner serves as a vessel for transferring energy that relaxes the body. You can, good question. It can be either touching or not touching. As a massage therapist, you probably would guess that I prefer touching. I think it's more effective. But for people, for those of us who have trauma backgrounds, myself included, sometimes touch can be very threatening. And one of the things that's been wonderful watching at the center is that some people who don't feel comfortable with touch at all when they start really end up feeling very comfortable. Is that clear?
Yes.
Okay. Other questions? Right here. I'm sorry? No, not yet. I'm just being a smart ass. But you're asking a great question, okay? Because I get questions from across the country. How do you find good Reiki people? Because unlike massage, there's no regulation. And that's good and that's bad, okay? So there's no standardized testing. So what I would say is word of mouth can be very helpful. You want to know who they studied with and how long they studied. Before you study with them, you want to go have a treatment. And you want to ask them how often they Reiki themselves. And if they don't answer every day, you want to go someplace else. Because how can you keep that plumbing system, good for... But I help a lot of people. There's also an International Association of Reiki Practitioners. There's a Celebration of Reiki group here, and I can put you in touch with them. There's going to be a big conference at the end of this month. I'm happy to be a resource for anybody who is looking. Of course I don't. Oh, please. Why did you have to ask me that question? For 25 years, my husband and my daughter have been saying, when are you doing a website? But I do have a card, and I do have an email. And more importantly, I have a cell phone number, and I answer texts, mostly.
Wow.
Question over here.
Oh, there's one. Okay.
Cynthia, thank you again for all of this. I'm going to stay on the Reiki topic just for a second, and just for information purposes. The first time I had Reiki was actually when I was hospitalized up in the Portsmouth Regional Hospital for depression 7 years ago. They operate 3 days a week up there in the unit.
You're kidding.
No.
I got to meet them.
Yeah, and they're very, very good. So that started me going to Reiki, and there are places around for anyone that's looking. I mean, to go onto Google and look it up. The thing, I guess my question would be, what I found, and I kind of stick with the same person or people, because the experience isn't the same with each person. And I'm not saying that if it's not a good experience, it might not be good for somebody else, but it's almost like you have to be a match in some way. And I'm just wondering what your thoughts are on that. Have you experienced the same thing?
I would totally agree, but I would say that, what's your name?
Joe.
Oh, of course, Joe. Sorry. It's sort of like change of position, huh? I would say yes, but I would say that applies to every modality and every kind of medical treatment as well. I think the interaction is very important. I do think that it's particularly important when you're dealing with hands-on work. So I would say that the same is true with massage therapists. I'll just digress a minute and give you all a warning around that. I think of myself as pretty sophisticated when it comes to massage and Reiki. I've been doing them, practicing them for 25 years. And several weeks ago, I was supposed to be going away to a spa. That didn't work out, and I really needed massage. And so I called up a number of places, and I decided, I'm going to be so smart. I'm going to get both massage and reflexology. How many people know what that is?
Speak into the mic.
Oh, sorry. Massage and reflexology. Reflexology is massage on your feet, basically, okay? And so I went to this Chinese place where you could do both. And the person who worked on my back went too deep, too fast. And the next day, I ended up in the emergency room with vertigo. Now, I had made assumptions that I would know if it was trouble, but I was sort of trying to be a little too macho and not say, hey, that's a little too deep. So it's really important to be in touch, and it isn't that notion, no pain, no gain, okay? And so it's very important to have a good relationship and a connection with your practitioner. Does that answer your question, Joe?
Yes.
Okay. Over here.
Yes, thank you. Is Reiki equally effective on bipolar disorders as it is on the sort of depression that you're describing that you experienced?
Do you mean in terms of mania, or do you mean in terms of, it's sort of...
Either, both.
All right, let me just say this. This is really important. Reiki does not profess to be curative. The difference between healing and curing is that curing means it goes away, but healing helps you deal with it, sort of modifies the thing. I believe that Reiki may be helpful for any kind of condition, for any or non-condition. I think it's great for life, for just sustaining. It's a spiritual practice, and it's not religious. I want to be really clear about that, okay? But so my answer is unequivocally yes, but it depends on what your expectations are. I don't think you should do it in lieu of medication. I have never done it in lieu of taking some low-level meds. But I do it, here's the best analogy I can make. When I had pneumonia, I took antibiotics, but I also Reiki'd myself every day. And both of them helped me. It didn't cure the virus or the bacteria, but it helped my energy. It helped my immune system. And that's what I think is a real plus for Reiki with anything. Is that helpful?
Yeah.
Okay.
Good evening.
Good evening.
Now, I see an individual who suffer from several mental disorders, and on top of that, have overwhelming physical issues. In your own words, you've been in a lot of different psychiatric medications. You've been hospitalized. You're in the field, obviously, doing very well. Not just, you know, what I see here, there's a lot of emphasis on medication. It really bothers me when people do discuss that, and they throw names, and, you know, some people have a wonderful cocktail. Mm-hmm. You're certainly familiar with the DBT and CBT and mm-hmm. all the other things. This is not what I wanted to ask you. My question is to you, how do you feel, in your opinion, about alternative medicine?
Okay, I'm going to play rabbi, and I'm going
to... And I will be more specific, cannabis.
Oh, cannabis. I wonder, is Chandra still here? Oh, I have a student who is a cannabis activist. And I have a family member who's quite active, quite strong on cannabis. I have mixed feelings about it, is the honest truth. The jury is out for me. I think it can be really helpful for people, but I think people can get addicted and be very, very negatively impacted.
Well, the reason I ask you, it seems to me you're a very big advocate of ECTs. You know, this is not my first rodeo. You know, I've been diagnosed with bipolar approximately 25, 30 years ago. You know, it's an overwhelming condition. You know, obviously, you know, whenever you've been diagnosed, and if it is what it is, you'll have it for the rest of your life. The key is to be stabilized. Me personally, I'm against ACTs. I've been on approximately, I can't give the percentage, maybe 70% of a psychiatric medication. You know, and I have a very good rapport with my psychiatrist. Make the long story short, for the past 2 years, I've been on cannabis. I have really never done this when I was younger. I'm 57 mm-hmm. years old. Mm-hmm. And, you know, like everything else, you know, I consider this my medicine.
Yep.
And to be frankly honest with you, you know, again, I can't take the bipolar away. It's an overwhelming condition. But to be frankly honest with you, it does magic for me. I'm personally very disgusted that it's legalized. But then again, it is what it is. You know, it's dollars and cents.
May I ask you a question?
Yeah, please. Well,
if it's so wonderful for you, why are you upset that it's legalized? That seems inconsistent to me.
Well, the reason I'm upset that it's legalized, that first of all, the stigma is still there. Anybody, you know, have the devastating mental disorder is still going to be stigmatized. But I can only speak for myself. When I went through all the steps to get the license, and it was really a pain in the neck to do that. You know, this was 3 years ago, and I got the license, and I went through all the steps, and, you know, when I went for the first time in dispensary, and, you know, I don't know much about the cannabis, you know, just to give you a little information, you know, among the sativa, that's, you know, whatever, you know, that's magic sometimes. Sometimes flowers are the same. But it did such an effect on me that, and I talked to a lot of people who had licenses, and a lot of them got it from their friends who are doctors and so on. A lot of people don't take it seriously. But the reason I ask you this question, because in some ways, I'm sorry.
All right. It bothers me when you are such an advocate for ECTs, which is a much more serious way to treat depression or bipolar than cancer.
Let me just say one thing in conclusion, okay? I think that there are costs and benefits to every treatment. And I am in no way saying that any of what I do is for everybody. However, I suggest that people attempt to be as open as possible about what the options are. And all I can do is talk about my experience, and that's different from your experience. And I'm actually, thank you for letting me know that cannabis has been so helpful for you, as I have seen it be for some other people. Okay, thank you.
All right, well, thank you, Cynthia. Please give Cynthia a hand.